Wondery Plus subscribers can listen to Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan ad-free right now. Join Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts.
This spring, if you'd rather spend time enjoying your lawn instead of trying to keep it alive, there's good news. TruGreen is the easiest and most affordable way to get a beautiful lawn. All you have to do is water and mow, and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and even some things you might not even think of. They'll do all of it, while you can do literally anything else. With True Green, you could have your lawn looking as good as a putting green. That's not hyperbole. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour. True Green offers a satisfaction guarantee, and they have a verified best price promise, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people guaranteed.
This episode is brought in part to you by Audible, your go-to destination for thrilling audio entertainment. Whether you're looking for a hair-raising experience to enjoy while you're on the move or eager to dive into sinister and shocking tales, Audible has an exclusive collection of thrillers from best-selling authors that will keep you on the edge of your seat. Like James Patterson's first audio-only thriller, The Coldest Case. Experience stories like never before, where every chilling detail is brought to life by captivating sound design. Plus, as an Audible member, choose one title a month to make yours forever. And now, new members can try Audible free for 30 days. Just visit audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500. That's audible.com/WonderyPod or text WonderyPod to 500-500.
I'm Ed O'Keefe in Washington, and this week on Face the Nation, a bridge collapse in Baltimore is the latest crisis in America's transit system, and an Easter Sunday reflection on faith in America. Cleanup is underway at the Port of Baltimore this weekend following the sudden and deadly collapse of the Francis Scott Key Bridge after a cargo ship crashed into one of its pillars.
The nation's economy and the nation's workers are relying on us to move quickly and to move together.
We'll get the latest from Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott and Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, who will ask whether the nation's roads and airports are ready for the travel surge this spring. Then, Ukraine is pummeled by a fresh barrage of Russian missile and drone attacks. We'll ask House Intelligence Chairman Mike Turner about the timeline for aid to Kyiv, Israel, and more. Plus, the head of the World Food Program, Cindy McCain, joins us to discuss the dire hunger crisis in Gaza. And finally, we'll hear from two faith leaders about the power of hope.
Sometimes we have to walk toward the light even when it's still dark.
It's all just ahead on Face the Nation. Good morning. Welcome to Face the Nation. Margaret is off and happy Easter. We begin this morning with that terrible accident at Baltimore's Francis Scott Key Bridge. It remains in the Patapsco River, but crews have taken the first step of cutting into the twisted steel and stabilizing the wreckage so divers can find the four remaining workers, presumed dead. The Coast Guard says its priority now is to create a smaller channel so at least some ships can pass through and access the port, which remains closed. For the latest, we're joined by the Secretary of Transportation, Pete Buttigieg. Mr. Secretary, happy Easter. Thank you for spending part of it with us, and good morning.
Happy Easter. Good to be with you.
Part of the reason we wanted to chat with you is because, you know, we have this incident in Baltimore. We've seen parts of planes falling out of the sky. You've described the fact that it's a national crisis, that more than 40,000 people are killed in car accidents each year. We're going to work our way through some of this, but let's begin in Baltimore. How long is it going to take to remove that ship, clear out the debris, and reopen the channel?
We haven't received a timeline yet, but what I can tell you is the work is now underway. Parts of the non-federal channel are already being worked on, and there is a 1,000-ton capacity lift crane on a barge being put into place now. There's another 600-ton crane on its way to back it up. This is going to be a very complex process. There are even now forces acting on that steel, so it takes a lot to make sure that it can be dismantled safely, to make sure that the vessel stays where it is supposed to be and doesn't swing out into the channel, but it has to be done because that is the only way to get into most of the Port of Baltimore. And of course, it's important not just to the people and the workers of Baltimore, but to our national supply chains to get that port back up and running as quickly as possible. Then you have the process of getting the bridge back up. That's going to take longer, but that work is already getting underway as well.
And is there any sense of how long it would take to rebuild that bridge?
We haven't received estimates on that yet either. I can tell you the original bridge took about 5 years to build, but that doesn't necessarily inform us about the timeline on the reconstruction. A lot goes into how that reconstruction will be designed, how the process is going to work. Right now, we don't fully know everything we need to know about the condition of the portions of the bridge that did not collapse. Obviously, that work is underway right now.
To that point about funding, we've heard that it sounds like most of this is going to be paid for by the federal government, either about 90%, 80%, depending on how it works, the rest by the state. Where's that money going to come from?
So we're using an authority called the Emergency Relief. This is through our Federal Highway Administration. That's how we got those first $60 million out, and there will be more where that came from. Now, it is possible we may need to turn to Congress to supplement that fund. That has happened in the past. If you remember the 2007 bridge collapse in Minnesota, ultimately about $260 million put together, including funds that were put through Congress on a bipartisan basis. And I hope and expect this, too, will be a bipartisan priority.
So what exactly would be the pitch to any skeptical lawmaker who says, why on earth should we have to pay for this?
Well, the pitch is your district could be next. And also, this has historically been bipartisan. And I'm not just reaching back to bygone eras. Remember, the infrastructure package itself, President Biden's infrastructure plan, went through on a bipartisan basis. A lot of people didn't think that was possible when we got here in 2021, but the president never gave up on the idea. And sure enough, a lot of Republicans were willing to cross the aisle, work with President Biden, work with Democrats to get this done.
On another matter, this past week, Boeing announced some big changes in its leadership. The CEO, the board chairman, the head of the commercial airplanes unit are all leaving by the end of the year. Are those changes enough to satisfy concerns about the company?
Well, one personnel change or several personnel changes are not the same thing as what we most need to see, which is a change in culture. Whoever takes these new leadership positions and everybody else at Boeing, especially those senior leaders who are accountable for the planes that Boeing produces and the work that company does, they need to demonstrate that they put safety first. FAA has been putting Boeing under a microscope ever since this incident happened in January. And frankly, there were a lot of concerns about what the FAA administrator saw in the course of those visits and in the audit. He gave Boeing about 90 days to come up with a comprehensive plan to show that they're on the path to deliver the right kind of quality and safety. We're about 30 days into that. There are regular check-ins, and FAA is not going to allow Boeing to increase their production until they demonstrate that they can do it safely.
You know, Thursday was the busiest day of the year so far, at least in terms of TSA screenings, because we're seeing an uptick now ahead of spring break or in the midst of spring break for a lot of people. But given these aviation incidents, the blown off door on the Alaska Airlines plane, the panel that fell off a Delta flight recently, what would you say to those who are scared to fly right now?
Well, I would say that every time I step onto an airliner, whether I'm going to look at a bridge or whether I'm flying somewhere with my husband and kids, like we will be later this week, I know that I'm participating in the safest form of travel in America, and that what makes it the safest form of travel in America is all of the work and all of the people who stand behind that, including the men and women of our FAA. We're talking about an extraordinary safety record. And just think about this mode of travel. It involves being propelled by flammable liquids in a metal tube through the sky at nearly the speed of sound, and again, is the safest way to travel. That is because of extremely rigorous standards and processes for inspection. And that's why so far, since this administration arrived, there have been about 3 billion passengers getting onto airplanes in the United States, and 100% of them getting to where they need to go.
I know when a lot of people see you on television these days, they may still think to themselves, oh, I wonder if he still wants the big job one day. Now that you've been closer to it, working alongside a president, is it still something you aspire to?
Well, I certainly have a new perspective on just how demanding that job is, watching President Biden deal with so many concerns, challenges, and opportunities for this country. And I'm proud to be a small part of the big team that helps him get that done. I sincerely don't know whether I will run for elected office of any kind again. What I do know is that I've been asked to take on a big job. I'm honored and humbled to do it. It's hard, it's rewarding, and it's taken about 110% of what I have to give right now.
All right. Well, we're honored and humbled you spent part of your Easter with us. Our best to Chasten and the kids, and we'll talk again soon.
Thanks very much. Good being with you.
We turn now to the mayor of Baltimore, Brandon Scott. Mr. Mayor, thank you for spending part of Easter with us. We appreciate it. After this bridge collapse this past week in your city, what is the most urgent need right now in Baltimore?
Well, the most urgent need, because our focus will always be on those families. I am focused on the total impact of on humans, right? And that begins with the loss of life. That then goes to what's going to happen for those families, and then the economic realities following this. And that's where our focus is going to continue to be. We have the salvage operation underway as of yesterday, with one crane and one barge working to start to cut some of the bridge out. That work is happening through the unified command, but we are and always will be focused on the human impact of this tragedy.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. What more can you, as a city, be doing for those four families? And then more broadly, for the roughly 15,000 workers whose jobs are tied in one way or another to the Port of Baltimore?
Well, listen, I said from day one that my office would be there to support the families in every way possible. We already set up a fund that now has over $300,000 into it for those families, and we will support them throughout this. That could mean that they need ongoing trauma care. That could mean in the future they need help with different jobs and things like that. But we also have to focus on the impact to the workers and the businesses at the port. I first have to be thankful to President Biden for having the SBA allow us now to have these businesses apply for grants through SBA to be able to keep their business open, keep those folks employed.
You're talking, when you say SBA, about the Small Business Administration that's offering now loans of up to about $2 million to the affected companies. You know, ultimately, Congress is likely going to have to get involved in some of this to provide federal relief. What, if any, kind of direct outreach have you done to lawmakers in both parties to try to make the case for what Baltimore needs?
Well, listen, I have the best congressional delegation in the United States Congress. I don't have to reach out to them because they've been there on site talking with us, talking with the impacted individuals. And we know that they are going to do everything in their power to bring back resources for this tragedy that doesn't just impact the city of Baltimore and the state of Maryland. This port is the number one port for cars and farm equipment. So this matters to folks in rural North Carolina, in Kansas, in Iowa. This matters to the global economy, and it does not. This should not be something that has anything or any conversation around party.
Secretary Buttigieg told us that there's still no sense of how quickly this cleanup will happen or how quickly the bridge will get rebuilt. What happens to the economy of Baltimore in the meantime?
Well, right now, that's the things that we're looking at, right? We're looking at how we're going to offload some of the stuff that is in the port and maybe use our partners at Trade Point Atlantic to help with some of that. I'll be meeting with labor leaders and the actual workers myself tomorrow to talk about what kind of other supports that they need while we all wrap our heads around and figure out how we can support them and keep as much commerce flowing as possible. This is going to be a long road. This is not going to be a sprint.
This was a tragic accident, but it seems these days when something like this happens in this country, there are always conspiracy theories and a lot of misinformation thrown around. And in the case of this accident, some downright nasty things said about you online this week. I've got to ask you, one of the wilder things is some conservative critics blamed the bridge collapse on diversity, equity, and inclusion policies in Maryland. Diversity, equity, inclusion, better known as DEI to a lot of people. They called you, some critics did, the DEI mayor. What did you make of that when you heard it?
Well, as I've said already this week, we know, listen, I am a young black man, a young black mayor in this country. We know that there are a lot of racists and folks who don't think I should be in this job. I know that. I've been black my whole life. I know how racism goes in this country. But my focus is always going to be on those people. I didn't want to be out there that night answering questions about DEI. I'm worried about the loss of life. We know how ridiculous that is. Those folks are afraid, as I said this week, to use the N-word. This should not be even in conversation. We have to remain focused on the mission at hand and continue from my vantage point to prove those people wrong about people that look like me by doing my job in the best way that I can and ignoring the noise of folks who simply want to be divisive and are afraid that their way of life, where people that don't look like them and think like them can be in control, can be in power, and actually be better at the job.
Well, we thank you for spending some time on this Easter talking to us about the situation.
Thank you. Happy Easter.
Face the Nation. We'll be right back in 1 minute. Stay with us.
Achieving a gorgeous grin from home isn't a total mystery with BiteClear aligners. Just don't be surprised if all of your sleuthing friends start asking, "What's your secret?" Begin by ordering your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95. BiteClear aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer flexible financing, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Thanks for sticking with us. We go now to the Republican chairman of the House Intelligence Committee, Ohio Congressman Mike Turner, who joins us this morning from Dayton, Ohio. Congressman, chairman, good morning to you. Our understanding is that Speaker Johnson plans to hold a vote on funding for Ukraine aid when Congress returns a week from tomorrow. Is that still the plan?
Well, first off, happy Easter. I was at Westminster Church in Dayton celebrating with Christians around the world Christ's resurrection this morning, and I appreciate you having me, and that you've included a faith piece in your report today. With respect to Ukraine, I mean, this is one really where I think the world has seen that this is a war of aggression by Russia, that this is authoritarianism versus democracy, that just the brutality that is occurring, the murderous nature of what Russia is doing has to be responded to. We have to continue our support. The speaker has made it clear that he supports Ukraine, both directly to Zelensky publicly, he's made these statements, and to the Secretary General of NATO. The speaker has made very clear statements that when we get back, it's the next top agenda after having just passed all the bills that fund the federal government. I believe this is going to have overwhelming support in Congress, and we'll put a bill on the president's desk.
Is it going to have overwhelming support from fellow Republicans, or are you going to have to make tweaks to the legislation as currently written to either include loans that Ukraine would have to pay back or potentially tuck in something regarding border security to get across the line?
Well, I think there already is significant and very strong support among Republicans and certainly across Americans across the country. Now, as this package moves, certainly there are going to be some discussions, in both the Senate and the House. I've had discussions about the border itself, and certainly there have been discussions about the manner in which the non-military, the humanitarian aid is structured. But I think overall, we're going to get a package that is going to be negotiated with the Senate and the White House so that we have a bill that the president can sign.
Will whatever gets done pass before Congress takes its next week-long break, which is scheduled to begin around April 22nd?
Well, it's certainly my hope. We're too, as President Zelensky has made clear to Speaker Johnson, we are at a critical point. CIA director, the Secretary of Defense, everybody has made it clear that we are at a critical juncture on the ground that is beginning to be able to impact not only morale of the Ukrainians that are fighting, but also their ability to fight. Putin knows this. This is obviously an area where we cannot allow Putin to win. Our European allies are saying that Putin's goal is a war beyond Ukraine with Europe. We need to stop him in Ukraine.
On that point, in an interview this past week with CBS's Charlie Daggett, the Ukrainian President Zelensky said his country will lose the war to Russia if he doesn't have American support. I'm just curious, given your strong support for Ukraine, in your assessment, how much damage has already been done by congressional inaction?
Well, it certainly has been difficult. We have certainly seen an emboldened Putin, but we've not seen significant losses or of territory on the battleground in Ukraine itself. We certainly see it strained. We've seen a lack of ammunition. We've seen even rationing of ammunition, which is just heartbreaking and certainly has an effect on their ability to fight. But even beyond just the issue of this supplemental and getting weapon systems replenished, we need to give them longer range weapon systems. The White House has been hesitant to do so. Congress has called for that. President Zelensky has called for that. What this would do, it would allow them to back off the Russians. Currently, the Russians have weapon systems that are attacking from distance into the Ukrainian side, right on the front line. This would give the Ukrainians ability to push Putin back and hold that front line.
You're talking about Patriot missile batteries and other longer range missiles that the president has said is at least for now a step too far because it could provoke Russia into
it's the attackums. It's the attackums, and I think it's long range, 300 kilometer, it's a kilometer attackums. Those, I think, the administration is on the verge of being willing to provide. They've already provided Patriots, which of course is the air defense system that really is so critical for Kyiv right now.
Got it. So, bottom line, because you seem pretty hopeful this morning, but if we come back to you in a month, your thinking is the House will have passed this, the Senate will have passed this, the president will have signed off on it.
There are a majority of members of the House, a majority of members of the Senate, including over the 60 votes that are needed, and a willing president to sign a package that would deliver this necessary aid to Ukraine. And I'm certainly hopeful we find a vehicle as quickly as possible to get that done. Speaker Johnson has certainly committed himself to that.
You think the Speaker's willing to put his job on the line in order to get this done? Because he is facing some threats from fellow Republicans.
Yeah, of course. Of course, unfortunately, the Chaos Caucus has continued to want to stop everything that occurs in Congress. It's not as if they have an alternative plan. They're just against those things that are necessary and that we're doing. This is necessary for national security. Hakeem Jeffries, minority leader for Democrats, has made it absolutely clear that he will not join with rebels in the Republican side to take down Speaker Johnson on this. And I think we're certainly going to see broad support in Congress to get this job done.
Speaking more broadly about Congress, 20 Republicans have announced their plans to retire from Congress so far this year. By the end of April, 5 will have departed in the middle of their terms. Are you aware of any other Republican members heading for the exit soon?
No, and this obviously is very unfortunate. This has been a very strange time period where we see that the Senate at a 50-50, we see the House at 50-50, even the presidential race was run basically at 50-50. It's almost unfolding that way, perhaps again. And it shows that we can have radical fringes, even radical individuals who don't really have an ideology or an agenda other than chaos, that can cause disruptions. And that's what we have seen. That certainly makes it difficult for people who just want to get the job done. In the area of national security, I think Speaker Johnson's made it very clear that we have his support to get national security agenda items done, and I think we will.
You mentioned it is Easter Sunday. You said you've been to church this morning. I got to ask, President Trump this past week unveiled what he calls the God Bless the USA Bible, which not only has the words of scripture in it, but also the text of the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, and a few other things. Do you think it's appropriate for the former president, for the likely Republican nominee, to be selling such a product?
I haven't really seen that. I've heard some people talk about it. I think I'm more concerned about the White House restricting the ability of children to put religious symbols on Easter eggs for the Easter egg roll at the White House. I'm glad that CBS gives people the right to express their religious freedom. I can't imagine that we're certainly in a situation where the Biden White House is restricting, especially that of children, their ability to express their religious freedoms.
Okay, but you wouldn't buy a copy of this Trump Bible, would you?
I'm not writing a check for that.
Okay. Congressman Mike Turner of Ohio, thank you for spending time with us this morning. We'll see you soon.
Thank you.
We've learned that at least two of the people killed in the collapse of the Key Bridge were originally from Guatemala. Last week, we sat down with the president of Guatemala, Bernardo Arevalo, while he was in Washington and asked why so many of his citizens are leaving to come to the United States.
Almost 20% of the Guatemalans living today are abroad and mostly in the United States. And this is a huge amount. of our population. They are doing so particularly from those regions where you cannot find work or economic opportunities.
You said in your meeting with the Vice President yesterday, quote, that you recognize that many of the problems we face are structural and longstanding and cannot be solved in a short period of time.
Exactly.
Nor without support and cooperation from the United States and other key international friends. With respect, why should the United States keep sending money to help Guatemala?
What we are trying to say is fundamentally about cooperation is not sending money. Cooperation can be by creating conditions in which we can invite you to invest in Guatemala and establish factories, works that can begin to produce and create jobs.
That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient, comfortable. Ah.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Welcome back to Face the Nation. Ceasefire negotiations between Israel and Hamas are underway again today in Cairo as the conflict nears the six-month mark. In Jerusalem, Easter traditionally draws large crowds. Celebrations are muted this year because of the war. CBS News senior foreign correspondent Holly Williams is there.
In the Church of the Holy Sepulchre this morning, where many Christians believe Jesus was buried, they celebrated his resurrection. Easter is a time of hope for Christians, even with the Holy Land in the grip of war. Jerusalem is a contested city, claimed as a capital by both Israelis and Palestinians. Now members of the tiny Christian minority, around 15,000 believers, say they're under attack. There's been a spike in assaults by ultra-Orthodox Jews, including spitting at Christians and even desecrating this graveyard.
We have here the hotel, it's named Casanova.
Alessandro Salema is a Palestinian Christian who showed us around Jerusalem's ancient Christian quarter.
It's a difficult time for Christians in Jerusalem.
Yeah, it's really difficult because you see it's no people, no pilgrim. The situation here is so bad.
Around 1,000 Christians live in the Gaza Strip, where they're hoping simply to stay alive. Many have taken shelter inside churches in Gaza, praying for protection. But one church compound was hit by an Israeli airstrike in October, killing at least 18. In Tel Aviv last night, anti-government protesters filled the streets near Israel's Ministry of Defense, angry at Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's failure to bring the remaining hostages home. By some counts, these were the biggest demonstrations against Netanyahu's government since the war began.
Ships carrying more than 300 tons of food aid headed to Gaza yesterday. And Ed, this past week, the International Court of Justice ordered Israel to allow the unhindered access of humanitarian aid into the Gaza Strip, saying that famine is, quote, setting in there.
Our thanks to Holly Williams reporting from Jerusalem. One of the international aid groups working to get relief into Gaza is the World Food Program. And on Friday, we asked its executive director, Cindy McCain, what needs to change on the ground so her teams can operate there?
We need access. We need full, unfettered access. And right now, we don't have that. We can occasionally get a few trucks in. We can occasionally get up all the way to the north, but it's not consistent and it is not to scale either. All of the other issues regarding maritime and airdrops and all those are all good, We need any way to be able to get food in any way we can, but they can't take it to scale. We really need access to the road, and we need to be able to get up to the north all the way without being caught at checkpoints and turned around.
I read the World Food Program estimates simply addressing the basic food needs will require at least 300 trucks to enter Gaza every day and distribute food, especially in the north, as you mentioned. But you've only managed to get about 9 convoys of trucks in since the start of the year. That's nothing, right?
It's nothing. It really is. We were able to yesterday, or today, I guess it was, get 9 trucks in, period. We also were part of an airdrop today that was 6.1 metric tons. That's nothing. We just cannot continue this way. As you know, famine is imminent in the north. And so unless we can really convince our diplomatic groups and our political groups around the world to help convince the Israelis that we must get in, and we must do it in a sustained and unfettered way. We can't. People are going to die otherwise, and they already are dying.
When you or your colleagues speak with Israeli officials about getting that access, what is the reason they're giving you why they're not letting you in? Do they not understand the situation, or is there some other reason?
Well, I'm not really sure where the mistake has been made, but I do know that there's been accusations that somehow the UN isn't doing their job, which couldn't be further from the truth. So I think, again, it's politics. I think it's something that various factions are involved in. All I need to know is when and where we can take the food in, make sure that we can distribute it. That's what I want to know from the Israeli government.
You're especially concerned as well about what's happening in parts of Africa, specifically Sudan, South Sudan, and Chad. And you've said this could become the world's largest hunger crisis. Why is that?
Well, quite frankly, it's the forgotten crisis now. Sudan is no longer paid attention to in the world media. And things haven't stopped there. People are still fighting. There is no food. We have no access. And we're also fighting a climate change issue there as well. So it's almost a combination of a perfect storm. With 2.2 million refugees across the borders in various countries, especially Chad, and the funding sources that we have right now and our ability to be able to fund, it just isn't meshing. We don't have enough money, and we need to be able to make sure that we can feed the refugees that are across the border and also get access into Sudan from the western side, the southern side, through South Sudan, and through the north. We've got to get food in there as well, because it can be and will be, I pray not, the next largest humanitarian crisis that we will know.
And not only a humanitarian crisis, you've suggested it could be a real national security risk for the United States, right?
Very much so. People migrate. The bad guys get mixed up in all of this. Food is the major element here in being able to keep populations stable and keep them healthy as well. With those two things not tended to, then people migrate, they run, they take their families, they do anything they can to feed their families.
You've made an interesting point that I think is a good reminder to all of us that these hunger crises around the world are not being caused by natural disasters, but by man-made events and conflict. And nowhere right now, perhaps at least in this hemisphere where we sit, is that most apparent than in Haiti. What is the situation there as you understand it?
It's catastrophic. We WFP are still in there, and we still are working in the north somewhat and somewhat down towards the center. But it is a very dicey situation. We are continuing our school feeding programs. But once again, as you've seen, there have been evacuations of UN personnel out of there. This is a diplomatic solution. This is a man-made crisis, and we need a diplomatic solution to it. And we need it now. We need it right now.
You know, we'd be remiss if we didn't ask you while we have you about the death of the late Senator Joe Lieberman, who, of course, was such a good friend to you and to your late husband. What did he mean to the McCain family?
Oh, he was Uncle Joe to my children. He was a friend to my family. And I had the extreme opportunity of watching two men together not only navigate the difficulties that the world offered up to them as in what they did, but also watch them solve problems together in a way that was gracious and kind and loving towards humanity. And I had the good fortune of being able to call him my friend, too.
Executive Director Cindy McCain of the World Food Program, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
On this Easter Sunday, we thought today might be a good opportunity to reflect a bit on faith in America, especially given all the trouble the world is facing. We spoke on Thursday with the Catholic Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Cardinal Gregory, and the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, the Right Reverend Marion Buddy. And we began by asking them how they counsel parishioners through these tough times.
I would say that we are part of a broad Christian faith that encourages us to trust and to believe that fundamentally our God is a God of love, and that God, the source of all that is good in the world, is with us. And that doesn't negate or soften the reality of the struggles that we face and certainly the difficulties of the world. And in fact, the witness of Jesus would say, no, go to those places, be present, be open, and trust that the worst that happens isn't the final word.
One of the things that I try to remind our people of is that in spite of the difficulties that we are currently facing, and they are serious and they are deep, but they are not the way that God intended his creation. In the book of Genesis, repeatedly, it says that God, after creating the heavens, the earth, he looked at it and he saw it was good. That's the statement that we need to remind our people of, that God's creation is fundamentally good, flawed by sin, flawed by our hatred and violence, but still substantially a good creation.
Got to be hard for people to appreciate that or to be reminded of that, whether they're dealing with something personal or they're seeing what's happening in their communities or in the world. And certainly, there is plenty of good that goes on, but there's...
It requires practice and discipline to focus on goodness and to be a source of goodness. It's not hard to be negative. It's not hard to be even cynical about the world. That's actually really easy to do. People of faith are called to a higher, are called to set our gaze higher and to be those who are not only looking for good, but actively trying to promote it.
It's been 4 years since essentially the world locked down in the
yes.
midst of the pandemic.
Yes.
And that's when the two of you really began to do a lot of your work together. You're no strangers to each other.
Right.
We
met the weekend before everything shut down.
We got in just under the wire.
And like many others, we're able to maintain your relationship, but from a distance, of course. Mm-hmm. How are we doing spiritually in the 4 years since that began?
There's an uptick in church attendance. Now, we didn't begin with a robust assembly to begin with, but we are watching the numbers return. The one cohort that I'm concerned about, two cohorts really, would be our elderly who are still somewhat hesitant to come out. But the outreach to our young adults, our young people are not approaching organized religion with the same value structure that their parents and their grandparents had. So we've got to do more to draw that. We've got to market the church.
A couple of things are truly striking. I think the rise of mental health concerns across the country, regardless of religion or affiliation, and the sheer numbers. I was listening to someone who was working in the criminal justice system here in the district saying that there's a direct correlation with the rise of youth violence and crime that we're seeing with the dislocation that young people experienced during the pandemic when there was just nothing right. for them. I also feel that perhaps some of the polarization that we experience as a country was exacerbated by that. And so to the degree that we can be instruments of healing and of friendship and goodwill across the country, I feel like Christians are at our best when we do that.
If we can model for the world, not just for the young people, but if we can model for all people that it is possible to have friendships, relationships, and personal affection for people that you have differences with. That's a wonderful gesture of what we are really called, certainly as people of faith, to live and to engage in.
And with the rising numbers of, as we see it all across the country, anti-Semitism, anti-Islamophobia, just the concern, I mean, just if the interfaith community, the leaders and the churches and the mosques and the synagogues, if we can remember our friendships with one another and stand with one another in these times, we can do a lot. We can do a lot to bring that caustic energy down.
The two major candidates we have running for president invoke Christianity. I know this gets a little tricky, but we have one who is now selling Bibles that also have copies of the Constitution and a Bill of Rights in them. But the other is the second Catholic president who goes to church every Sunday, who observes the holy days of obligation and builds his schedule around them, but doesn't talk at all publicly and is uncomfortable speaking about his own faith. Are you comfortable with the role and the level of Christianity in our politics today?
Whereas faith used to be the voice, the moral voice that political people, whether they adhered to everything, they would turn to find the moral compass with faith. I think in some cases, it's the political world that's beginning to set or claiming to set the moral voice. We've switched position. There is a great need, I believe, to place faith in its proper position, which is not necessarily antagonistic to the political arena, but to seize the responsibility of being that guiding principle, that moral light for our people to turn to.
I'm very concerned about the way the message of Christianity is being distorted in our country right now. I think it's a cause for deep concern. I feel it's an abuse of the faith. And I have to be very careful because I'm not perfect in my understanding of what it means, A, to be a perfect Christian. I'm not a perfect Christian and I'm not a perfect American, but I think we are walking on very thin ice now. I would encourage anyone who buys a Bible to read the Bible, and in particular to read the teachings of Jesus, and then to set our policies, if we're going to call ourselves a Christian nation, against the highest aspirations that Jesus calls us to.
In the case of the president, do you get a sense that his regular attendance and adherence to the faith resonates with American Catholics?
I would say that he's very sincere about his faith. But like a number of Catholics, he picks and chooses dimensions of the faith to highlight while ignoring or even contradicting other parts. There is a phrase that we have used in the past, a cafeteria Catholic. You choose that which is attractive and dismiss that which is challenging.
Or, as Thomas Aquinas would say, you allow your conscience to guide you.
Right? Is there something on the menu he's not ordering, in your view,
so to speak? I would say there are things, especially in terms of the life issues, mm-hmm. There are things that he chooses to ignore, or he uses the current situation as a political pawn rather than saying, look, my church believes this.
It's also possible to be a practitioner of the faith as a public leader and not require everyone that you lead in your country to be guided by all of the precepts of your faith, right?
And in my coverage of him, it seems
That's
what he believes.
That's what I would interpret.
Your concern is that he should be more explicit in his own personal belief, which is a personal opposition to abortion, but an understanding that as a public leader and in a free society, he's not to be
placing that on everybody else. Right. I'll just say that I worship with the president when he comes to Washington National Cathedral, and I will say the one thing about him that I admire tremendously, there is not a funeral of a statesperson or a statesperson's spouse that he does not attend, stay through the entire service, and speak from the pulpit as in eulogy. And I find that example to be an expression of authentic faith.
Is there any Biden effect in the pews, perhaps?
I would not put a lot of emphasis on that.
Okay.
He does attend church regularly with great, devotion. But he also steps aside some of the hot-button issues or uses the hot-button issues as a political tool, which it's not the way I think we would want our faith to be used. The issues of life begin at the very beginning, and they conclude at natural death. Mm-hmm. And you can't pick and choose. You're either one who respects life in all of its dimensions, or you have to step aside and say, I'm not pro-life. I'm, in one side of the equation, I feel that I can support this dimension of life, but in others, I would step aside.
I love the spectrum of life. I think you can be an adherent of the spectrum of life and still respect a woman's right to choose her in reproductive health, and including when to have an abortion in the early stages of pregnancy. So I'll just say that as a Christian, I believe that that's possible and still hold to the full spectrum of life.
We know in the case of the president, he communicates occasionally with the Holy Father, with the Pope. Do you get any sense that the Pope conveys your frustrations to the president?
I would not be at all surprised to have Pope Francis have had the opportunity to speak directly to the president regarding that. One of the things that I think Pope Francis does and does extraordinarily well is that he engages people. This past week, Pope Francis met with two different fathers, one Palestinian and one Jewish, both of whom had lost a daughter during this conflict. And what was absolutely marvelous was rather than turn against each other, they decided, with God's grace, to say that this experience of pain that they both had suffered brought them together rather than drove them apart.
And that's a resurrection story right there.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah.
Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Cardinal Gregory, Episcopal Bishop of Washington, the Right Reverend Marion Buddy.
Thank you.
This was fantastic. Thank you so much for spending some time with us. Let's do it again.
Thank you.
And happy Easter.
Thank you.
Happy Easter,
happy Easter to you. And to you.
Happy Easter, my dear friend.
And we'll be right back.
CarMax is putting peace of mind back in car shopping by putting you in the driver's seat to find a ride that's right for you. Because at CarMax, we believe you shouldn't just settle for a car. You should love your car. That's why every car we sell is CarMax certified quality, so you can be sure with upfront pricing that's the same for every customer. So don't settle. Find love at first drive and start shopping now at CarMax.com. CarMax, the way car buying should be.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can spend another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. With available H-Track all-wheel drive and three-row seating, my whole family can head deep into the wild. conquer the weekend in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
You can see our full conversation with Cardinal Gregory and Bishop Buddy on our website and YouTube channel. Just search for Face the Nation. That's it for today. Thank you so much for watching on this Easter Sunday. Margaret will be back next week for Face the Nation. I'm Ed O'Keefe. Today's guests were U.S. Transportation Secretary Pete Buttigieg, Baltimore Mayor Brandon Scott, Ohio Republican and House Intelligence Committee Chairman Mike Turner, the Executive Director of the World Food Program, Sidney McCain, the Catholic Archbishop of Washington, Wilton Cardinal Gregory, and the Episcopal Bishop of Washington, Marion Buddy. The executive producer of Face the Nation is Mary Hager. This broadcast was directed by Shelley Schwartz. Face the Nation originates from CBS News in Washington. For more Face the Nation, we're online at facethenation.com and on YouTube. You can also follow the Face the Nation and CBS News Radio on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Face the Nation is also rebroadcast on our CBS News streaming network at 1:30, 4, and 10 p.m. on Sundays, and it's available on our apps, CBS News and Paramount Plus.
If you like Face the Nation with Margaret Brennan, you can listen early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus in the Wondery app or on Apple Podcasts. Prime members can listen ad-free on Amazon Music. Before you go, tell us about yourself by filling out a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
The Hargan women seem to have it all.
From the outside looking in, we were blessed. My mom was amazing.
But as detectives would soon learn, there was a lot going on inside the Hargan household.
Ashley and I have been calling my mom and the house and Helen. Okay. No one's answering.
63-year-old Pamela Hargan gunned down in her own home. Her youngest daughter, Helen, lay dead upstairs.
Patrol, when they arrived, assumed or thought that there might have been a murder-suicide.
But for the detectives on the scene...
There were things about the scene itself that were concerning to us on day one.
Who would want to kill their mother and their little sister?
There is no boogeyman here. It is exactly who we think it is.
I'm Peter Van Sant from 48 Hours. This is Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings. Listen to Blood is Thicker, The Hargan Family Killings early and ad-free starting May 1st with a 48 Hours Plus subscription on Apple Podcasts.
Survivor's back, and so is On Fire, the only official Survivor podcast. And we have a twist, a new co-host, the winner of Survivor 45, Dee Valladares.
Hi!
Listen to On Fire, the official Survivor podcast, wherever you get your podcasts.